If I told you, as I told you last week, as we look forward to the end of what I believe to be the tragic and failed George Bush presidency, I'm going to devote some interviews to exploring new directions and new policies. And last week, I looked at security strategy and planning with Thomas Barnett, author of The Pentagon's New Map, War and Peace in the 21st Century. And today, I continue looking at that set of issues with Andrew Bacevich, author of The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. I'd heard of Dr. Bacevich and read some op-eds, but as soon as I saw his interview a few weeks back with Bill Moyers, I knew I had to talk with him. I was surprised and pleased the next day when I looked at Barnes & Noble for his book and that it had jumped to number one in sales. I believe Andrew Bacevich in his new book pulls things together in ways that I hadn't seen before. Things like our politics of personality, the rise of the imperial presidency, and our national culture of consumption. I say each week that I'm looking for pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work, and I believe today's guest is pulling some of them together in ways that make our problems clearer and perhaps change more possible. To set things up a bit, let me list, as I did last week, some of what I believe to be the key issues and questions in the area of security and military conflict. Is the United States actually the sole superpower? And if so, what does that mean? If the United States is pursuing empire, what are the costs of our imperial adventures? How should national security really be properly defined and pursued? What actual threats do we face? How should they be prioritized? How do we challenge what I have called a strategy-free consensus of McCain, Obama, and really most of mainstream political figures and experts that we need to sustain or increase present levels of military spending? What realities are we obscuring by the flawed notion of a global war on terror? How can we best isolate the worst terrorists as pariahs within their own societies? On what principle should our relationship with the rest of the world be based? What are our actual security resources and assets, and how can they most wisely be employed? What are the wisest and most necessary security investments we can make? And finally, what would an honest, realistic, and wise discussion of security choices and priorities look like? Andrew Bacevich, professor of history and international relations at Boston University, served 23 years in the U.S. Army, retiring with the rank of colonel. He also lost his son in Iraq last year. A graduate of the U.S. Military Academy, he received his Ph.D. in American diplomatic history from Princeton. His writing has appeared in Foreign Affairs, The Atlantic Monthly, The Nation, The New York Times, The L.A. Times, The Wall Street Journal. He's the author of several books, including The New American Militarism and his newest, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. Welcome, Andrew Bacevich.
Well, thanks very much for having me. Let me say your list of questions is really a good list.
Thank you. I mean, I've thought a lot about this, and I think that sort of frames what we're going to talk about. Before we jump into it, I like listeners to get to know a bit about the people behind the ideas and the work. Briefly, what was your path from the U.S. Army to the work you do today?
Well, my service in the Army coincided with, in a sense, the late Cold War. I got out of the Army in 1992, and I certainly was then, and I imagine I would still describe myself today as a committed Cold Warrior. I thought that was a necessary cause. I thought that the Soviet Empire posed a security threat. But I also thought that if and when the Cold War ever ended, that the United States might go back to being more of a normal nation. Which to me implied not isolationism, but I guess to put it in the starkest terms, a retreat from empire with greater attention being given to the well-being of our own people. What actually happened in the aftermath of the Cold War was that our appetite for empire increased, and especially worrying to me, our emphasis, our willingness to use military power also increased dramatically. And this was not simply something that conservatives or neoconservatives promoted, but it was something that liberal Democrats in the Clinton era promoted. So it was the failure to make what seemed to me to be wise adjustments to the end of the Cold War that set me to rethinking U.S. foreign policy.
Okay, that makes very good sense to me. Let me, before we go into a lot of more detail, let me just we've just come out of two political conventions, and in an article in the American Conservative in March of this year, you claim that Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama is the best choice for conservatives in the fall. You also said both of them endorse the notion that a global war on terror provides the right frame for thinking about U.S. national security policy going forward. Do you still hold that Barack Obama is the choice of conservatives, and could you explain that a little more?
Well, the case I made for conservatives to support Obama was a very narrowly framed case. I mean, I don't believe that Barack Obama is a conservative. He's a liberal, and I don't use that as some kind of a poisonous accusation. People on the left have principles to which they adhere that happen to be different from the principles that people on the right believe in. But my case for supporting Obama really was that he has said that he would end U.S. involvement in Iraq. And my belief is that if Americans elect Obama on that basis, and if he follows through on that commitment, in effect we will be rendering a judgment of the Iraq war as having been a mistake, a misguided commitment. And if that happens, my hope is that there might be an opportunity for a fundamental debate about U.S. foreign policy.
Right.
I would hope that in that debate, if it were to occur, that conservative or realist views might have a chance of being heard.
Now, right.
Having said that, mm-hmm. I'm not actually convinced at this point that Obama is any more interested in that fundamental debate about foreign policy than Senator McCain is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then let's delve down deeper into what comes up in your book. One of the things you also say is, of course, that the fundamental problem, I'm quoting now, facing the country will remain stubbornly in place no matter who's elected in November. What will not go away is a yawning disparity between what Americans expect and what they're willing or able to pay. How does that play in all of the rest of our lives beyond the military, and then how does it influence our attitudes towards security in the military?
Yeah, I mean, I think to putting it in very simple terms, we are no longer willing to live within our means. I mean, that is certainly the case in many, many, many families, individual families. I mean, our propensity to save, to put things up for a rainy day is essentially non-existent. This is all related to this penchant for endless penchant, insatiable penchant for consumption. But that also exists at the national level. We supposedly live in a time in which there's been a conservative ascendancy in politics. Conservatives once believed in doing things like balancing the budget, pay as you go. We've got an ostensibly conservative president, and this year the budget deficit's going to be close to $500 billion. The total national debt is now closing in on $10 trillion. If you look at the entitlements to which we are committed, they're utterly unaffordable. So the big problem, it seems to me, is this refusal to live within our means. Exacerbating the problem is the inclination, especially apparent in the last 20 years, of policymakers to rely on military power to try to prolong or to push back the day of reckoning. But the truth is, as we've learned in Iraq and we're learning in Afghanistan, our military power is nowhere as great as people imagined. I mean, your first question was, are we the sole superpower? It seems to me that the whole concept of a superpower has come to be pernicious, because it gets in the way of us actually seeing ourselves as we are and seeing our circumstances the way they are.
We spend as if we have more money than we have, and you're saying we use our force as if we have more power than we have.
Absolutely.
Okay. One of the other things I found very interesting was your take on the presidency and the imperial presidency, but a lot of people have talked about that for the last year, but you actually link it to the creation of the president as the super celebrity. You say, I'm going to read here, beginning with the election of John F. Kennedy in 1960, the occupant of the White House has become a combination of demigod, father figure, inevitably the betrayer of inflated hopes, pope, pop star, scold, scapegoat, crisis manager, commander-in-chief, agenda settler, moral philosopher, interpreter of the nation's charisma, object of veneration, the butt of jokes, all rolled into one. How does that exacerbate the problems we're talking about?
I think it gets in the way of us having serious politics. I mean, I find almost nauseating the emphasis given to these two individuals now running for the presidency, Obama and McCain, which seems to imply an expectation that whatever the outcome of the election, if your guy wins, then your guy is somehow going to save the country, is going to wave a magic wand, is going to make all the problems go away. Both candidates, I believe, have promised to achieve energy and independence in
right.
something like 10 years.
Yeah.
Well, it's not going to happen. Now, trying to achieve something like energy independence is, I believe, a tremendously important strategically imperative. But it's something that would require an effort on the part of the nation, which certainly includes, at the level of the federal government, the Congress, but also would include state and local governments, and above all, would include a commitment on the part of the American people. And none of that exists. So to me, the hoopla that surrounds the presidential election in some respects ends up being an excuse for us to avoid understanding that the collective responsibility for our problems really lies much closer to us, the people, than it does to, you know, whoever happens to live at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Yeah. Now, I'm sort of guessing that, as I said, I haven't heard these sort of notions woven together quite this way before. But this whole idea of the presidency the president is a superstar, and these presidential elections, interminable presidential election this time, as a reality show, an entertainment show or something, I think that grows out of, you know, other forces in our society, but it actually has made it much easier for George Bush and Dick Cheney and company to push this imperial presidency, don't you believe?
Oh, I think absolutely. I mean, I think that, the shrewd people on the inside have understood that our dysfunctional political system and these expectations that somehow the president's supposed to sort things out really has provided an opportunity for accruing a tremendous amount of power at the center, and then using that power in ways that are using it in secret, using it in ways that reality gets concealed from the rest of us. My point is simply to say that shame on us that we have permitted this to happen. Shame on us that, in a sense, we tolerate it.
Yeah, shame on us. I would second you at every level, from the citizens who view it as entertainment to the congressmen who abdicate, you know, time and again their role in this. And you hearken back to a time when the president was a significant figure. Obviously, you know, Franklin Roosevelt was a huge figure in this country, but that there was a give and take in the legislative branches and between all the areas of government that actually real politics and real taking on of public problems took place.
Well, you know, I don't want to romanticize our political past. That would be a big mistake. But it does seem to me that there was a time in the 20th century and in the 19th century when there were figures in the Senate and figures in the House of Representatives who had as much or perhaps even more national standing than the president itself, so that there were other voices that were heard, and they were people who who didn't view themselves as simply members of a party in which they're supposed to go along with the herd. I mean, Senator McCain advertises himself as a maverick. Real mavericks were people like Robert La Follette back in the World War I and 1920s era. So we've lost all that, I think.
You make a very interesting point about President Carter, and I'm gonna first say what you've been saying about how were we to achieve or seriously aim for energy independence, that would call for sacrifice on the part of the people. It would call for us reorganizing the way we do things. People have said the same thing. We've tried to fight two wars without any involvement of the people. The sacrifices are all by the troops and the troops
Absolutely.
Alone. And You can speak more to that, but I'm going to read something you wrote about President Carter. I think we've misunderstood and underestimated President Carter. He was the one president of our time who recognized, I think, the challenges awaiting us if we refuse to get our house in order. You describe Reagan as the modern prophet of profligacy, the politician who gave moral sanction to the empire of consumption. Obviously, those two, by the public, by the pundits, by conventional wisdom, are held in opposite regard.
Right. I mean, I emphasize in the book what I think is the great historical significance of the speech that President Carter gave in July of 1979. This was the so-called Malaise speech. He was castigated, laughed at the time for what he said.
And kind of doomed his presidency.
Yeah. Speech in contemporary politics.
And how so?
How so? Because, as you suggested, we have to remember this was at the time of the second energy shock, when sort of the awareness of our growing energy independence was still beginning to sink in among Americans. And Carter said in this very important speech, "Look, energy independence is suggestive of a country that is going down the wrong path toward dependency, and is going down that path toward dependency because we are embracing a false understanding of the meaning of freedom." And his concern was a concern about materialism and consumption and self-indulgence. And he summoned Americans to say, look, we need to rethink. We are devoted to freedom. We need to ask ourselves what we really value about freedom. And we need to embrace those true values. And the way to begin to embrace an authentic version of freedom is by attacking head-on this problem of energy independence. We need to change the way we live to be independent in terms of energy, but also change the way we live in order to embrace an authentic definition of freedom.
Right. In other words,
of course, Ronald Reagan said, you don't need to do any of that. You don't need to tighten your belts. We can have everything we want. It's morning in America.
Yeah.
And Reagan told us what we wanted to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And we embraced Reagan, the great majority of us, and we rejected Jimmy Carter. And I think that was a fateful, the election of 1980 is a fateful moment in American history. And in my judgment, we took the wrong path.
Yeah, in other words, what Carter was saying, and you know, in rereading his words in your book, it really brought it home to me. I mean, he was actually asking questions on a level of culture and perhaps even on a spiritual dimension.
Yeah.
About what is the nature of this country that was founded on ideals and ideas, mm-hmm. not on power.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to make the argument that makes Carter a great president. In many respects, he was a failed president. But I am arguing that of all of our presidents over the past 50 years, he was the one who had the clearest understanding of the dilemmas that we face. And he invited us as people to contemplate them, and we said no.
Yeah, and what's interesting, as you point out, he was not maybe that good as a president, wasn't that good in many ways. But the fact that others didn't pick up his question, his charge, but kind of once Reagan won his overwhelming victory, I think we've seen ever since then people basically wanting to promise what you want.
Oh, I think you're exactly right. I mean, they are in a sense they are all successors of Reagan, and the important questions that Carter posed still have not been answered.
Yeah, well, yeah, despite, and they aren't even
the fact that our dependency on foreign oil and the indebtedness that we are accruing is orders of magnitude greater than they were back in 1979.
That's right. At that point, that was only 9 years after we had stopped being the largest producer of oil in the world.
Right.
We were in a very different position in terms of...
Right.
There's points at which you point out...
Change then would have been much easier than change is going to be now.
Right, and change that started then would put us in a position one can hardly imagine. Let's talk right now about the current problems. Iraq, Afghanistan, you say here, were we to actually gauge the actual existing threat, and there is a threat. I mean, 9/11 happened. There are people out there who want to kill us. But were we to actually gauge that threat in a realistic way, we would see that open-ended global war is not only unnecessary, but it's probably counterproductive. And there are better ways to go about keeping us secure than to engage in global war.
Yeah, it seems to me that we should understand that 9/11 happened less because Osama bin Laden and his band of cutthroats were so smart and so savvy and so cunning than that we just let our guard down. We weren't paying attention. We left the door unlocked and they came in. Violent Islamic radicalism is, as you said, a real threat. But to compare it to the threat posed by Nazi Germany, as the Bush administration has done, is absolutely nonsense. We need to see the threat, in my judgment, as, in essence, an international criminal conspiracy. Now, this is an international criminal conspiracy that's not looking for money. It's one that's motivated by a religious fervor. But they are criminals. And the proper response to criminality is police action. The basis of our strategy should be that the United States should lead an international, comprehensive, ruthless, protracted effort to identify and root out the al-Qaeda network and to destroy it. And that does not, should not entail occupying and or invading and occupying countries. So my problem with framing the strategy as a global war on terror is that it seems to emphasize military action, large-scale military action, when it's a much smaller scale, more precise action that actually is in order.
Right. And on the other hand, or in the other piece of that, it would seem to me, is so that's tracking down the criminals. As I believe I said at the top, it seems to me that the other piece of that is to take those actions that would isolate those sorts of terror, those sorts of criminals, those sorts of terrorists as pariahs within their own societies.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, in addition to the international police effort, it seems to me that we should try to reconceptualize the idea of containment and try to consider how containment would provide the basis of a strategy relative to the Islamic world. And I don't mean containment to be operationalized the way it was operationalized during the Cold War. We don't need a new NATO, but we need to take actions to prevent the problems of the Islamic world, like violent radicalism, from getting at us. And I honestly believe that over time that Muslims themselves will come to recognize that the program offered by people like Osama bin Laden is an empty one. It doesn't lead anywhere. I believe Muslims themselves will come to understand that they have to, that Islam's going to have to reconcile itself to modernity. Doesn't mean that they're going to be like us. They shouldn't want to be like us. But it means, I think, that they will eventually, over time, come to accept the principal manifestations of modernity and will be able to live in some semblance of harmony with them. That's a long-term project, but they need to figure out how to live with modernity. It's not up to us to try to impose modernity on them, which, of course, is what the Bush administration has been trying to do in both Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right. It seems to me it's a much more difficult, much more nuanced analysis. It goes back to the same sorts of kinds of deep analysis Carter was proposing with regard to freedom,
right,
in terms of, oh, okay, we had thought modernity would just inevitably sweep sweep the planet. It turns out there's a bump in the road here. Mm-hmm. Robin Wright says that, you know, we're asking them to accept democracy before they've had the Enlightenment or Reformation. Now, that doesn't apply to the entire cultures, but it applies to certain segments of the cultures. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me what the deep analysis is how do we make it most likely, how do we, in everything we do, make it most likely that that movement takes place?
Right. And mucking around in their business has exactly the opposite effect.
Yes, exactly. If someone says only kill the infidel and you go around reinforcing the image that you are the infidel,
right. You
leave little hope. If I gave you 30 seconds, what should listeners do?
Well, you know, I've been asked a lot. I've been asked that quite frequently since this book came out, and I don't have a good answer. I'm pretty cynical about politics, and I don't see a lot of willingness to, on the part of most Americans, to look at ourselves in the mirror. It seems to me the most that we can do as individuals is to model what it is to be a good citizen. I mean, to show in the way we live our own lives, our personal lives, our professional lives, that this is the way the country ought to work. This is what American society should manifest. This is a true and authentic version of freedom. You know, if you do that, I don't know that that's going to, transform the entire country, but at least one could have the satisfaction of knowing that you did your best in your own sphere, and that's about all I could say.
So one thing would be rather than assuming the problems are to be solved by the president or that the problems are out there, it's to say, am I living the pursuit of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in a way that really matters?
You said it better than I did, but
okay.
That's exactly what I meant.
So again, the book is The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. Thank you, Andrew Bacevich, and keep up the good work.
Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome.